Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The nation's unemployment rate jumped to 8.9% last month, the highest jobless rate in 25 years. But the pace of layoffs is slowing. It was the fewest jobs lost in 6 months. President Barack Obama today announced a plan to change unemployment benefits to encourage people to go to technical school or community college while they're unemployed. Right now, in some states, those receiving unemployment are not allowed to enroll in training programs or college. And the president's plan would change that and would increase Pell Grants to help pay for those programs. Community colleges are already seeing an uptick in enrollment. An informal survey by the American Association of Community Colleges shows they're seeing anywhere from 2 to 27% more students. So could they handle even more? Well, joining us on the line from North Carolina is Dr. Bud Marchant. He's president of Central Carolina Community College. And Dr. Marchant, are you seeing more students come to your school?
Absolutely. This spring, we had a 13% increase over spring of last year in the number of students entering training programs.
And primarily, what are they looking for?
Primarily, they are looking for short-term programs that they know that jobs are available in, and they're really wanting to get back into the workforce as quickly as possible.
Where do they know that these jobs are available? What fields?
Well, right now, we have a great many openings in the medical field. We have a lot of medical training programs, some short-term, some not so short-term. We actually do the ADN, which is the program that leads to the RN certification, registered nurse, which is very popular. We also have a great deal of programs that deal with green technologies, which are very, very popular and are also in high demand.
Hmm. Certainly, we've heard an awful lot about green jobs, but there's not a lot of construction happening right now. So is the training going to pay off?
Well, it is in that we have, for example, a sustainable agriculture program. And what we are finding is that people who are in this program are actually going into business farming for themselves. The number of farms in our region, unlike many places in the country, small niche farming is actually increasing. We have a biofuels program, which is growing. We have a biofuels company in our area, which is hiring. So we find that those green jobs are, they are out there. And then others are preparing for when the economy does turn around. We have a green construction program, which, you're right, there are not a lot of buildings going on right now. But when the economy does improve, we anticipate that demand for the knowledge of green construction technologies will be great.
You know, North Carolina has one of the nation's highest unemployment rates. I think it's about 10.8%. You've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. Are the folks who are unemployed or lost jobs in other industries, are they the people who are coming back for retraining primarily?
Well, yes, we are seeing an increase in the numbers of people coming in all areas, in all age groups. We're seeing older, younger, some with college degrees, some with no high school degrees. So it's a variety of people. Most of them are looking for some place to upgrade their skills and get back into the workforce.
Have you had to create classes, too, to accommodate not only the increase in students, but the sort of change in industries, really?
We have, and we've particularly had to ramp up, like I said, in the medical and the green technologies field. We are offering considerably more sections of short-term training in medical programs, such as certified nursing assistant, EKG technician, phlebotomist, those types of training. We are offering as many courses as we possibly can.
But they do have the jobs for these folks.
They do. Yes, they do.
So sort of a middle-aged person who has to change gears now and get into another field because of this economy, do you think that it's relatively easy, I guess, for them to go to a community college, get the training they need, and then retrain themselves to be employed in this economy?
Well, I don't know if easy would be the right word. Many of the people that are coming to us have been in a manufacturing environment or some other workforce environment for quite some time. Sometimes we are finding that they lack the prerequisites or the necessary base skills in order to be able to do the types of things that the new training requires. For example, phlebotomist has got to understand mathematics to be able to measure centimeters and those types of things. So sometimes we're finding funding, we need to do a little pre-work before we can actually put them into the training that they are interested in going into.
Dr. Bud Marchant, president of Central Carolina Community College near Raleigh, North Carolina, thanks very much for speaking with us and good luck.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's obvious to say that Americans' waistlines are expanding because we're eating too much. But why are so many people unable to stop stuffing themselves? Well, our next guest has a theory. David Kessler served as commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration under Presidents Bush and Clinton, where he took on big tobacco. He's a doctor, lawyer, former medical school dean, and he's helpless when faced with a plate of chocolate chip cookies. Kessler says that foods high in fat, sugar, and salt can change the brain's chemistry and condition us to overeat. He says the food industry knows this and is layering its products with those ingredients to keep us eating. Dr. Kessler's new book is The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. He says his research began 7 years ago when he heard one woman's story that sounded similar to his own.
I was watching a television show. It was Oprah. It was late at night. There was a woman on the show. And she said, I eat when I'm hungry. I eat when I'm not hungry. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad. And then she said, I don't like myself. Why was this woman who was so successful in all aspects of her life, why was she doing something that she didn't want to be doing, that she knew was not good for her?
Why could she not control her desire to eat?
The bottom line is that the neural circuits in her brain are being excessively activated. The learning, memory, and habit circuits are being stimulated, aroused by highly salient stimuli. Those highly salient stimuli are fat, sugar, and salt. Let me give you the pieces of the puzzle. Let me give you the science for a second. Let's start with the fat, sugar, and salt, and what starts this cycle of consumption. Take a vanilla milkshake. What's in the vanilla milkshake? Sugar, fat, flavor. What's the key driver? We published a paper. It's called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. In fact, it's sugar that is the key driver. But when you add fat, you make the food even more reinforcing. Animals and humans will work for reinforcing substances. Then we did work with our colleagues abroad in Italy, and we found that food that is multisensory, fat and sugar, that's stimulating, elevates and keeps elevated the dopamine response. We had always thought the difference between food and drugs was that certain drugs would elevate dopamine, and I'll explain dopamine in a second, right? But that foods, you would eat foods, and you would have your response would habituate. It would it won't stay sustained. What dopamine does is it focuses your attention. It tells you, in essence, that's important, focus on it. If I put your favorite food right in front of us at the studio and put it between us. I mean, pick a favorite food.
Cookies.
What kind?
Chocolate chip.
Chocolate chip cookies. Mm. And they're right here. They're warm and they're hot. They're mounds of chocolate. Are you talking to me or are you listening? Paying attention to those chocolate chip cookies?
I'm paying attention to those cookies.
Right. Then you understand dopamine. You understand what attentional focus is. So if you make something multisensory, and you have past learning, right, of that it was rewarding, that it was there was pleasure from it. You put those cookies in front of us. That visual, you don't have to even taste it. It's a cue. It will grab your attention. There'll be arousal. And how do you get it out of working memory? How do you release that? You eat it. And every time you eat it, you start the cycle again of consumption. Cue, attention, arousal, release. And every time you engage in that behavior, you strengthen the neural circuits. So that's the second piece of science. Let me give you the third piece. I was very interested in the epidemiology. How many people were like this woman that I saw on Oprah, who were eating when she was not hungry.
Because you're not talking about an eating disorder.
Not at all. Hmm. Not at all. We ask people, your favorite fruit in front of you, do you perceive a loss of control? Do you have a lack of feeling full, a lack of satiation? Do you have a preoccupation? Do you think about foods in between meals? Lack of control, lack of satiation, preoccupation with foods. Certain people, when I raise those three characteristics, look at me and say, what are you talking about? They can't relate. Others, when I raise it, say, you're describing me. Hmm. And we found that about 50% of obese individuals, about 30% of overweight individuals, about 20% of healthy weight individuals self-report having those three characteristics and scoring very high on those behaviors. And we call that constellation of characteristics conditioned hypereating. It's conditioned and driven behavior. Not only do you repeat it, but there's a driven component. You want it. Last piece of science. With my colleagues at Yale, with Dana Small, one of the great neuroimagers, we took people who have conditioned hypereating and we put them in the scanner. Now, the power of food comes from our ability to anticipate it. Not necessarily just eating it and putting it in our mouth, but if those cookies are there, that anticipation, that cue, activates the amygdala of the brain. What we saw in people who have conditioned hypereating, that amygdala, those neural circuits, become amplified when you are cued during that anticipatory phase. But what was even more fascinating was once consumption began, in people who don't have conditioned hypereating, that neural activation stops. But people who have a hard time controlling their eating, this conditioned hypereating, that activation continues until the food is gone. So there's a hyperactivation of the neural circuits. But understand, I'm not describing a disease. We're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. So if a bear came into the studio right now, again, you'd focus on that bear. It could be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be gambling, it could be sex. But for many of us, it's food. So your question, is this an eating disorder? No. It's part of what makes us human. We're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli. Food has captured our attention. The food industry has designed foods to be hot stimuli.
Welcome back. We're talking about overeating with Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the FDA. Kessler says, yes, we are responsible when we eat too much, but he also says the food industry is complicit by processing foods heavy in sugar, fat, and salt, foods that we learn to crave. And Dr. Kessler, you say what we need is food rehab. What exactly does that involve?
Now, let's just deal with one thing. Diets don't work.
And why not? Deprivation, you actually have a scientific reason for that, right? Deprivation does what?
It increases the reward value of the food. But more importantly, if your old circuits respond to all the cues in your environment, to those cookies, to your other favorite fruits, and I take those foods away for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, sure you're going to lose weight. I put you back in your environment. You still have that old neural circuitry there, that old learning. You continue to get bombarded. Of course, with that old neural circuitry there, you're going to continue to engage in your old behavior. The only way you can deal with that behavior, once that old neural circuitry is laid down, is to add on to that new learning. You have to have new learning.
Now, we will always want French fries.
Let's talk about that. Under certain conditions, the answer is probably true. If I stress you, if you're fatigued, if you're deprived, if there are not alternate foods around, you're going to probably want those French fries. But let's say those French fries are in front of you. What are the options? How do we cool the stimulus? First, you can simply say, take those French fries away. Get rid of the queue. But how realistic is it in our current environment? Another technique is that I can avoid being primed, P-R-I-M-E-D. Once you put that first French fry in your mouth, it enhances the stimulation, the neural activation. And that's, and you stay active, that brain circuitry stays activated until all the fries are gone. So you avoid being primed. A third way is to learn to eat in a planned way. So you set certain rules for yourself. I'm not going to eat between meals. And you condition yourself to do that. And that's what you want to do. Then when you're cued in between meals, if you know you're not going to eat, it's an impossibility, then the stimulus doesn't have the same ability to activate the neural circuits. But in the end, the most effective way to decrease the amount of stimulation is to change your relationship with the food, what psychologists call a critical perceptual shift. If you look at those fries and say, that's my friend, boy, is that going to taste great? That's going to only activate your reward circuits of your brain. If, on the other hand, you can get to the point where you look at those fries and say, that's not my friend, that's just fat and salt, then you cool off the stimulus.
Isn't a lot of what you're talking about essentially willpower?
It's not a matter of willpower. The brains of millions of Americans are being activated. And once those reward circuits are being activated, they are very powerful. And no one's given the people whose brains are being activated the tools. And no one's explained this. Pick any appetizer in a restaurant.
Right. So buffalo wings.
What is it?
Chicken.
Well, what part of the chicken? The wing is the fattiest part of the chicken, often fried at the manufacturing plant, then refried in the restaurant. The red sauce, sugar, fat. That white creamy sauce, fat, salt. So you end up with fat on fat, on fat and sugar, fat and salt, when you really look at what we're eating. It's not a matter of willpower. We're excessively activating the brains of millions of Americans.
This is personal for you as well. I read a Washington Post article that said that the man who took on the tobacco industry is helpless in front of a plate of chocolate chip cookies. Is that true?
One day I bought these great chocolate chip cookies and I did this experiment. I brought them home and I put them in front of me. And I wanted to watch my own reaction to the chocolate chip cookies. Even before my brain was engaged, I noticed my hand actually went for the chocolate chip cookies. And then I tried to avoid eating them and try to just observe my own thoughts. And what I found, I made it out of the house that day, but I ended up in one of the coffee shops a few hours later, sitting there eating a chocolate chip cookie.
So you were going to get that cookie.
Once you're in this cycle of consumption, the real question of the book is, why did that chocolate chip cookie have such power over me? What is it about that sugar, fat, and salt? Is it that sugar, fat, and salt? Or is it how my brain encodes that sugar, fat, and salt? And how, once I'm cued by that cookie, that past memory, that past experience, that sense that it was going to make me feel better, how it grabs my attention, how it arouses me, and how I only get out of that cycle, how I release myself by consumption. And every time I eat it, I only strengthen those neural circuits, learning, memory, habit, so that I do it again.
So have you been able to break yourself of it?
You never break yourself entirely of it. It's not what the public wants to hear. They want magic bullets. They want diet books. It's just not going to happen. But there are ways to cool it down. If you understand you're being stimulated, if you understand you're being bombarded, you can cool the stimulus. You can protect yourself. You can fight back.
Well, Dr. David Kessler, former FDA commissioner and author of the new book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pope Benedict will try to strengthen frayed ties with Muslims and Jews on his first visit to the Middle East. His first stop was in Jordan today, where the Pope expressed deep respect for Islam and said he hopes the Catholic Church can play a role in the Mideast peace process. His trip also includes stops in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. In Israel, Pope Benedict will find a small and surprising group of Catholics, former Jews who celebrate the Catholic Mass in Hebrew. The BBC's Middle East correspondent Tim Franks met some of them recently and prepared this report.
This is a Catholic Mass, as you may not have heard it before. It's being celebrated in Hebrew, in Jerusalem. Most Catholics in the Middle East are Arabic-speaking. A few hundred are Hebrew-speaking. Leading them is the patriarchal vicar, Father David Neuhaus. His own story is remarkable. His parents were German Jews who fled the Nazis and settled in South Africa. As that country sank further into the grimness of apartheid, the young David was sent to Israel to continue his schooling. There, he met a Russian Orthodox nun and discovered Jesus.
I had to then deal with what it meant for a Jew to join a church which is perceived by the Jewish people as one of a number of enemies in the history of the Jewish people. I was 15 at the time. I was only baptized when I was 26. It was a period of really trying to integrate these two identities, which I feel very strongly are my identity. This tension is, I think, very, very important in the lives of all those who are in our community coming out of the Jewish tradition.
Do you still go to synagogue?
I do. I have found a synagogue here in Jerusalem where the rabbi and many of the community members know exactly who I am. Exactly who I am, I insist, because it's a synagogue that welcomes non-Jews. I'm not exactly a non-Jew. I'm, in a certain sense, in inverted commas, worse than a non-Jew.
Not often do you hear a Catholic priest say that part of his identity is fulfilled through the synagogue service or through participation with friends and family in Jewish feasts. But Father David Neuhaus is not unique. Grigol Pawlowski is a Holocaust survivor from Poland.
I'm afraid to speak that I'm Jew.
Grigol Pawlowski, now 78 years old, talking about how, even after the war, he was afraid to tell anyone at a Red Cross orphanage in Poland that he was Jewish. Grigol had been 11 years old when he was separated from his mother and sisters, whom the Nazis then shot and dumped in a mass grave. It was the start of a journey to Catholicism, which ended with him being ordained as a priest in 1958. But he kept his secret identity for another 8 years.
I felt uncomfortable that I was denying to my mother and to my father the fact that I am Jewish. And so, in 1966, I wrote an article in a Catholic weekly, and there I told my whole story.
Through that article, Father Pawlowski made contact with the one surviving member of his family, his brother, whom he thought was still living in Russia, where he'd first escaped to. Instead, his brother had made it to Haifa in Israel. Grigol's conversion was a source of pain to his brother.
Because he was a very religious Jew. He prayed that I come back to the Judaism.
Much as Father Neuhaus explained, Father Pawlowski says that his identity, too, cannot be folded into neat boxes.
I'm a Catholic priest, and I also see myself as Jewish. On Yom Kippur, I fast. At Passover, I eat matzah. And close to where my mother and sisters were killed, there's a Jewish cemetery where there is a memorial to my mother and all those who were shot. And I will be buried there.
Here in Jerusalem, the swirling mix of the three great monotheistic religions throws up some extraordinary stories. Among those, the Hebrew-speaking Catholics have some of the most poignant tales to tell.
That report from the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Tim Franks, in Jerusalem. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
I wish to express, my personal regret and certainly the sympathy of our administration on the loss of civilian life in Afghanistan.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton commenting on the deaths of dozens of civilians during a U.S. bombing raid against the Taliban this week. These incidents, so-called collateral damage, are inflaming anti-U.S. sentiment in the Muslim world, especially when the deaths are caused by unmanned aerial vehicles or drone aircraft. Many U.S. military officials say drones are effective weapons against insurgents, but the Washington Post reports this week that some senior U.S. officials are beginning to wonder if drone attacks have reached the point of diminishing returns, if the political blowback outweighs the military advantage. Joining us is P.W. Singer. He's senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He's also author of the book Wired for War. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, apparently there are a lot of these different types of drones or unmanned aerial vehicles. Some of them carry cameras and sensors. Some have weapons. But let's focus on one fairly common type, the Predator, and that's the drone being used by the Air Force in many of its missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Can you describe this type of drone?
The Predator is a pretty amazing technology. It's remote operated. The pilot is actually on the ground. They're often thousands of miles away. Their communications with it are carried over satellite. So they may be sitting just outside Las Vegas, is one of our major bases for drone pilots, and yet the system will be over Iraq or Afghanistan.
So how does that work exactly? I mean, is it really sort of like this war games, almost video game-like operation of these things?
Well, you got to pull back and think about the phrase going to war. It always meant you went to a place where there was such danger, you might never come home again. You might never see your family again. Well, for these Predator drone pilots, their experience of going to war is basically they commute into work, and then they sit behind a bank of computers, they've got a joystick, and for 12 hours, they're operating this system. As one of them put it, you're putting missiles on targets, you're killing enemy combatants. And then, as he said, at the end of the day, you get back in your car, and 20 minutes later, you're talking to your kids about their homework at the dinner table. So it's a very fundamentally different experience of war. One young pilot, asked him what it was like to kill people from afar, and he kind of struggled with it. He went, oh, it's like a video game. Sure. But they are very serious in their tasks, and they don't treat it as a video game. They know that lives are at stake, including American lives. And actually, one of the things that's striking is that we're finding that the levels of combat stress for these remote pilots in some cases are actually higher than they are for combat units in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember one young Air Force officer talked about the difficulty they had of having to watch American soldiers die in front of them. They were operating a unarmed drone at the time, and they could only circle above while these American soldiers died in front of them on this TV screen. And then, end of the day, they go home, and their spouse is mad at them because they were late for the PTA meeting. So it's not just like a video game.
Well, let's talk about whether they're effective. A story in the New York Times quoted one person, a logistics person actually for the Taliban in Pakistan, who said drones had been effective, that the strikes thinned the ranks of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. He said he lost 29 friends. So have these been effective ways for the U.S. to really target certain militants and at the same time minimize the risk to U.S. troops?
You don't go from using a handful of these drones to buying 7,000 of them over the last 5 years. They are military effective. Look at these drone strikes into Pakistan. Of the top 20 Al-Qaeda leaders that we've gotten, 11 out of that 20 have been gotten via drone strikes. But there's a concern that they may well be having a strategic loss in all of this. And I remember doing an interview with the leading newspaper editor in Lebanon, and we're actually talking while there's a drone flying above him at the moment. And he described how these were, quote, just another sign of the cold-hearted, cruel Israelis and Americans who are also cowards because they send out machines to fight us. They don't want to fight us like real men. And all we have to do is kill a few of their soldiers to defeat them. And so when we're fighting this broader, not just tactical engagements on the ground, but a broader war of ideas, this is something you really have to keep your eye on.
I know effective is certainly depends on who wants it to be effective, but there are also reports that there were 60, I think, Predator strikes in Pakistan since 2006, and only 10 hit their intended targets, and there are hundreds of innocent Pakistani civilians killed. The loss of life of innocent civilians is something that people need to take into account here.
Exactly. You have a major blowback effect from that. And you can even see it in things like pop culture. One of the songs in Pakistan last year that was most popular was a song in which the lyrics talked about how America doesn't fight with honor. It looks at Pakistanis the same way it looks at insects. Now, that's not the kind of message that you want permeating pop culture there if you're trying to win this war of ideas.
And what about, in terms of what it does to us militarily, what about the level of caution exercised in making a decision to go to war, if we can call it that? What does it do when our risks are minimized?
Well, it's this incredible illustration of both the positives and potential negatives of these technologies. But I remember interviewing a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ronald Reagan, and he said, quote, "I like these systems because they save lives, but I also worry about more marketization of war to defray discussion of the costs of war, and that people are more likely to support the use of force if they view it as costless." And I thought that was a really remarkable way for describing the potential effect of robotics on some trends that are already happening in our body politic right now. You know, think about it this way. We don't have a draft anymore. We don't have declarations of war anymore. We don't buy war bonds or pay higher taxes for our wars anymore. And now we have this technological revolution that allows us to carry out force without sending so many people into harm's way and all the political consequences of that. And so we already had the barriers to war lowering in our society, and maybe this technology is the one that drops them to the ground.
You know, there are probably many people listening, though, who agree with that military leader who said, you know what, they save hundreds of lives. And maybe we're just at the point right now where we need to figure out exactly how to most effectively and safely use them.
We are at a sea change in history. I mean, these systems are revolutionary. I think of them as akin to the rise of gunpowder, the advent of the computer, the advent of the atomic bomb. That is, they not only force us to ask new questions about what's possible now, but also they force us to ask new questions about what's proper, about what's right and wrong. And it's a lot like the computer. You can't say, well, the computer is good or the computer is bad. No, it's the fact that it rewrites the rules of the game, that you got to figure out all the new ways, not only on how you're going to use it, but the proprietary of how you're going to use it. And a lot like the computer, we're not just going to say, well, we ain't going to use it anymore. No, we've already got, again, 7,000 robots in the air, 12,000 on the ground. One of the people I met with was an Air Force 3-star general who described how very soon we'll be using, quote, tens of thousands of robots. Mm. And it's a global industry. It's not just America that's building these. 43 different countries are working on military robotics today. And so we got to catch up to the fact that this ain't science fiction anymore.
P.W. Singer, Senior Fellow, Director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. His latest book is Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 20th Century. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. He was always known as Joe's little brother, but Dominic DiMaggio was a Boston Red Sox legend. DiMaggio died at his home in Massachusetts today. He was 92 years old. People often called him the little professor because of his eyeglasses and small frame, but he was a 7-time All-Star, and he still holds the Red Sox record for the longest consecutive game-hitting streak. Ironically, it was his brother Joe DiMaggio who put an end to that 34-game hitting streak, snagging Dom's line drive in the 8th inning of a Red Sox win over the Yankees in 1949. Dom DiMaggio and his Red Sox teammates, Johnny Pesky, Bobby Doerr, and the late Ted Williams, formed a lifelong friendship, documented by the late David Halberstam in his book, The Teammates. In 2003, Here and Now's Robin Young had a chance to speak with Halberstam, Pesky, and DiMaggio.
The right words.
Johnny Pesky, why don't you start? What was it about Ted Williams that made him sort of the center of your group?
Well, it looked like he had a light on top of his head. That's the way he affected me. And when he held court, he held court. And he had three of the best listeners to listen to him.
He commanded attention. When he walked into a room, he was tall and you had to look up to look at him. He just attracted attention.
Well, Doc, remember when we all got back after the war was over, he'd come into the clubhouse and in a loud voice, Captain Williams is here.
Wind up. Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is going, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams.
Did you all make each other better baseball players?
Yes. He led off. I hit second. Ted hit behind me. And our ultimate job, Robin, in baseball lingo, we had to get on base. We had a lot of fun playing it, too. We'd laugh at one another and say, well, you do this, you do that. But we went through the whole process like it was a stage play or something like that.
That's right. I mean, as a leadoff man, my job was to get on base. Because once I got on base, then I had Johnny behind me and have the guys behind us drive us in.
Talk about sacrifice. Fly.
Well, no, it was for the best interest of the team. That's what we're there for.
That's right.
Robin, but the great teacher says you got to get a ball, you get a strike, you got to hit it. And if you hit it, you better hit it hard.
That's Professor Williams,
yes,
your group.
Yeah, Ted. We sat in the corner of the clubhouse. I can still see it. Bobby here, Dominic, and I can still see Dominic with a towel over his shoulder having a cup of coffee. There's the Professor Williams, and I'm sitting alongside of him, and now he'd start, and he'd say, so-and-so is pitching. You got to expect this. You got to look for this. You got to look for that. And I said, oh, my God, you got to be a Rhodes Scholar to understand you.
Dom, Johnny, and Teddy, they were a fierce force, together scoring 100 runs in 6 years. And with another California native and future Hall of Famer, Bobby Doerr, they forged a legendary friendship. That friendship is at the heart of an elegant new book by author David Halberstam. It's called The Teammates.
It's not really my book. It's their book. And it's
Johnny Pesky and Dom DiMaggio recently appeared at a book signing with Halberstam, a couple hundred adoring Red Sox fans, and Boston storyteller Dick Flavin.
I've been along for the ride for so long, and I was along for the ride down to Hernando, Florida, and I'm still along for the ride.
Dick Flavin was official first friend to the Fab Four teammates. He was also involved in the story that prompted Halberstam to write the book. The story of how, right after the events of 9/11, Dom and Johnny, both octogenarians, decided to drive the 1,300 miles from New England to Florida to see their very ill and dying friend, Ted, for the last time.
At the time, I wasn't overly enthused about flying. And then my wife rebelled, and she said, you can't drive at your age. She says, I don't think you should be driving. And Dick Flavin happened to be with us and said, well, I'll come with you. Well, that opened up the doors. I said, that lit a light in my head. I said, oh, great, Dick. And I said, let's call Johnny Pesky.
Road trip.
Yep. I said, here it comes. And John jumped at the opportunity, and then the whole thing gelled together.
And we were all anxious to get there. Dick and Dom did all the driving. I sat back in the back seat like Mussolini with my arm. And I'm listening to this jibber-jabber up in the front seat. One of them get on the other about driving the car, when they should pass, when they should stay in the lane, and all this.
I had seen Ted rather often, so I knew what to expect.
When we went in to see him for the first time, I thought I was going to cry, because here's this man that was all man and had a great charm about him. Even in his loud voice way, he had charm. And we actually loved this person, this man that we admired so much.
When we walked in the front door, you have to picture, you walk in the front door, and about 30 feet away in the living room, he is sitting in this wheelchair facing the front door. So I open the door and I walk in first. John comes in behind me. And as I step aside, John sees Ted for the first time. Now, Ted doesn't see John because he can't see him that far away. And John is shaken. Yeah, and he sees this big rugged guy is worn down to a mere shadow of himself. And it affected him. And so when he finally recovered, he started walking dogwood toward him, and I kept yelling to Ted, Johnny's here, Teddy, John's here, Johnny Pesky, where? And when he finally saw him, it's hard to describe the look that Teddy had when he saw John. And it was just a grateful look. He was so appreciative that John was there visiting with him.
Well, that would be the same, I think, if this happened to any one of us, that we had so much care for one another, Robin. I think it boils down to that.
Ted Williams died on July 5th, 2002. His 70-year friendship with Dom, Johnny, and Bobby Doerr is now read about and celebrated by new generations of baseball fans. But author David Halberstam is not sure it will be repeated.
Four guys growing up all on the West Coast, coming to one team, a baseball mad town, in roughly the same time, having this friendship, the love. That won't happen again. Big money, free agency, planes instead of trains. You'll never have that kind of affection and human texture again. And they were appreciative of the good things and the good things that endured in their lives in the way that many Americans now take good things that happened to them for granted.
You left one thing out, how we loved it. We loved it.
Oh, yeah, Dominic and Bobby and me and Teddy. You know, we were known as the Big Four from the West Coast. We were the Rabble Rousers, but we had a great love for the game of baseball and for each other.
Johnny Pesky, Dom DiMaggio, and David Halberstam speaking with Here and Now's Robin Young in 2003. Halberstam died in 2007. DiMaggio died today at the age of 92. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.